This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. To this day, it is famous, notorious, the so-called Scopes Monkey Trial. High school teacher John Thomas Scopes was tried for teaching evolution in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. Matthew Chapman is a descendant of Charles Darwin, a great-great-grandson, and a couple of years ago, he got on a bus and traveled from New York City to Dayton to see the town's annual reenactment of the trial. Chapman climbed aboard the bus with the idea that he'd write a book about Dayton, the Scopes trial, and current attitudes toward evolution. But he wound up writing something entirely different. The title of the book he wrote in the end, Trials of the Monkey, an accidental memoir. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Matthew Chapman, this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Matthew Chapman was born in Cambridge, England. He lives in New York, where he writes screenplays. He has written many screenplays, including Consenting Adults and What's the Worst That Could Happen. Trials of the Monkey, an Accidental Memoir, is his first book. The publisher is Picador. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Matthew Chapman, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
Did you start writing the book you had intended to write?
No, I started doing research on the book that I intended to write, and then I got diverted.
And how was it that you got diverted?
Well, it was two things. First of all, I'd been working very hard for years. I mean, 10 years, I'd written one screenplay after another, each overlapping. And I was kind of exhausted, and I was offered this opportunity to write a book. And I'd always been fascinated by the Scopes trial, so I got on the bus to go down there. And then I was on the bus, and I couldn't write, and I couldn't make any phone calls. And I started to think about, you know, what it was like to grow up as a descendant of Charles Darwin, which is not such an extraordinary thing in England as it is here, in a way, in that sort of his theories, I think, are much more widely accepted there than here. But nonetheless, there was a huge amount of pressure, academic pressure, to succeed mm-hmm. academically. And I began to think about the way I'd reacted as a child, which was really to devolve as ferociously as I could, to avoid education, to drop out as young as I could. And I thought, well, if that was my reaction to it, you know, let's have a look at the others and how they were affected by it. My mother was an alcoholic and a great woman, but very unsatisfied. And so I just began to think about what it's like to be the descendant of a great man. And that's where the accidental memoir came in.
What did you know about your great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, when you were a child? Did you know about him, you know, the man, the real man, or was he a legend by that time, even within your own family?
No, he was very much a legend. And a sort of a respected legend. And I think that, I mean, you know, in England, you get Christianity in school. And so I was getting Christianity from the school on the one hand, and the theory of evolution on the other hand. And my parents were sort of not really Christians, although they kind of pretended to be. And I think there was a sort of a real feeling that the whole sort of Christian mythology about, the creation of the world was pretty ridiculous. And that sort of undermined the Bible in all kinds of other ways, particularly for me. And so I grew up with those feelings about him, that he was a man who had really had a very big effect on Christian belief.
You gave it a try, religion, right?
Well, I mean, it was as a child, mm-hmm. I did. Yeah, there was when I was young, I was very sort of. I really believed that you couldn't be good unless you have religion behind you, because it was so entrenched in life in England and in the school system. And but ultimately, you know, I started reading the Bible, and I found it. You know, when I was 9 or something, and I just found it kind of ridiculous. in the end. And so I moved away and became really an atheist my whole adult life, until I went to Dayton. And then I suppose I saw things in Dayton. I saw the way in which people had faith in Dayton. And, you know, both good and bad. I met people who I thought, you know, for whom I thought faith was essential, you know, that their characters would have simply fallen apart without faith in God. And then I saw people who I found very strident and irritating, and they had faith in a different way. And so I thought, you know, for me, faith is something that I don't want to have. Intellectually, I don't think it didn't feel right that I should have faith that there wasn't a God. That seemed to me to be as much of a stand as having absolute faith that there was a God. And therefore, I came back as an agnostic, which some people have misinterpreted as being a softening of my views. But in that sense, it hasn't been a softening, quite the opposite. I just think there's no way of proving it one way or the other. And therefore, in a sense, it's more radical to be an agnostic and say one cannot really have faith about this either one way or the other. And that's how I came back.
I'd like to talk with you about some of the people that you met in Dayton, Tennessee. Tell us, if you would, about Professor Wise.
Professor Wise, I liked him a lot. He and I disagree about, I think, just about everything that we could possibly disagree about. Professor Wise was I think he may have even been from Ohio. I'm not sure. Somewhere like that. And he grew up with a love and a fascination for science, and he collected things. And he was sort of like a junior Darwin. He was into fossils and birds' eggs and nature and so on. And then at the age of 9, he had a crisis. And he was obviously an extremely intelligent boy and living in a community that really didn't much respect the intellectual life that he had in his head. And at the age of 9, he decided he didn't know what existed and what didn't, except he believed that evil existed. And so he decided he was going to commit suicide at the age of 9. And then that Sunday he went to church and he heard what he describes as the salvation message. And he sort of had a sort of minor vision of Jesus and became a very devoted Christian. And that Christianity and his love of God continued in a sort of untroubled fashion in conjunction with his love of science until he was about 16. And then he knew enough about the literal interpretation of the Bible and enough about evolution to see that they were on a collision course. And so he decided to put this all to a physical test. And what he did was he got a Bible, a new Bible, which he hid from his parents. And he went through the Bible and cut out every single verse in the Bible that he thought was in contradiction to a theory of evolution and other scientific theories. And the idea was to see to what extent science undermined the Bible. And it took him 2 years. And at the end of it, he had the Bible with these sort of squares cut out of it. Not the margins, just the little verses themselves. And at the end of 2 years, he took the Bible and he laid it out on a desk. And he tried to lift the inner part of it, all the pages, up from the margin with a finger and a thumb to see if the Bible would physically hold together after everything had been taken out of it that science would remove. And he couldn't do it, and the Bible fell apart. And he decided that he had to abandon science because his love of God was more important to him than his love of science was. But it was a tragedy for him because he really loved science. And so about 6 months later, I believe, he then heard about creationism. And he thought, this could be the answer. I can have my love of God and my love of science because creationism will allow me to do that. And so he pursued creationism, but in a highly intelligent way and sort of questioning all of even the basic theories of the sort of creationist view. And he was so smart that he ended up eventually, having gone through the University of Chicago, he ended up at Harvard studying under Stephen Jay Gould, who, as you probably know, is the leading sort of Darwinian paleontologist, zoologist in America, a brilliant man, went through postgraduate under Stephen Jay Gould and emerged the other side of it, still a creationist, after many adventures, and then ended up at Bryan College, which is the college on the hill above Dayton, Tennessee, which was built in honor of William Jennings Bryan, who was the prosecutor in the Scopes trial. And so now he teaches creationism there. And he and I had a long talk, and then we went on a creationist sort of cave tour to sort of look at a cave that to any other person on Earth, any other scientist on Earth, is like clearly millions of years older. But Kurt wants to prove that, in fact, it could be only 6,000 years old, or I think 4,000 years old, because Noah, you know, the flood did it, is the view of all those sort of geological anomalies. So that's Kurt.
I wonder what the relationship between Kurt Wise and Stephen Jay Gould was like.
Well, apparently at the beginning it was rather adversarial. And then I think, you know, when you meet Kurt, you meet a man who is sweet, funny, highly intelligent. And I think on a certain level, as I said, when talking about faith, a man who needs faith to hold his character together. And so it's very hard to, however much you may disagree with him, it's very hard to dislike him. I like him a great deal. In fact, I've been down there since the book came out, and he was at first very angry about the book, and then we sort of got to laugh about it. And I mean, I don't know if you've read the book, but the book is very funny, and so he kind of appreciated the humor in it. And he and I, and in fact several other people in the town whose views I completely disagree with, we have a sort of strangely amiable relationship, because I think that what they see is that even though I went down there with a kind of slightly sneering approach to the whole thing, I came to be very fond of them. And the way in which, you know, as I said at the beginning, I didn't soften up intellectually. I mean, I don't think it's... I believe that being an agnostic is more radical than being an atheist. In a sort of human sense, you know, one doesn't normally go through life asking people what they believe and why they believe it. When I was down there, that's exactly the question I was asking. And when you talk to people about their lives and their hardships and their sorrows and what it means for them to believe in God, you see that sometimes faith is an absolute necessity. You know, in certain societies at certain times, I think there are other ways to deal with those issues, but for them it's clearly an essential part of their character and their life. And so I sympathize with it and, you know, got very fond of them.
There's a number of great folks in Dayton, Tennessee. I found myself very fond of Gloria.
Gloria was great. Gloria was a real sort of American woman. you know, it's an indomitable woman who had a lot of difficult things happen to her and difficult men in her life. And somehow she just, you know, lost this hotel that I was staying in. She had to sell it. But she just kept on going. And in her life, you know, she has faith too. And, you know, I met people who survived things that perhaps I wouldn't have survived without faith. And I even began to sort of think about my mother and her alcoholism. And to think that had my mother had faith, she might have recovered from her alcoholism and not died. And that faith, you know, because I think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a kind of a faith-based cure. I don't think they even call it a cure. And so, I mean, I can see the therapeutic value of faith, but I see something else as well, which is that I think that I believe there's a kind of an imbalance in American life between faith and skepticism. And I think we have far too much respect for faith and far too little respect for skepticism. And I think that there is a sort of weird connection between George Bush's statements about bin Laden being evil and not having a soul, and bin Laden's statements that America is the great Satan. To me, these are all completely ludicrous assertions. You know, what does this really mean? How does this solve the problem to say that bin Laden is evil and has no soul, to me doesn't really address the problems of the Middle East. You know, it's simply a mirror image of the same thing. And clearly, Bush is not evil, if one has to use that word in the way that Bin Laden is. But the way in which they base their thoughts, what they base their thoughts on, which is this belief in God and so on, it's identical. I know that's a very radical thing to say, but I think that it would be very helpful if one could take this moment in history and really say to ourselves, how different would things have been if the people who got on the plane and crashed them into the World Trade Center had been a little more skeptical about the existence of heaven? That's going to set the phones ringing, I suppose.
Matthew Chapman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Matthew Chapman is a descendant of Charles Darwin. He is the author of Trials of the Monkey, an accidental memoir. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. When you set out on that Greyhound bus in New York City, you were facing a crisis, I would say, kind of wondering, you know, where you were headed in your life.
Well, yes, I was facing a crisis that, again, you know, if I was a believer, I would have been able to survive a little better. I was exhausted with this constant screenwriting business, sick of the movie business, facing, you know, middle age, you know, without really the equipment. I mean, I think this is a thing that a lot of men feel, that, you know, we're taught how to be boys, but we're not taught how to be men. And so I was in a state. Yes, I certainly was. And this led to a number of catastrophes on the trip. You know, I went down there really to, the way in which I was conceiving the book was that it would all emanate from this reenactment of the trial that the town puts on once a year, which is a very funny event, really. It's very, you know, the motives behind doing a reenactment of the trial are very similar to the motives that got the original trial started in 1925, which are really economic. Mm-hmm. In 1925, the town, which had been a boom town 20 years before and had a population of 6,000, had fallen on hard times and now had a population of, I think, sort of somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. And some of the town people had heard about the ACLU offer to finance a trial, the defense of a teacher who would teach evolution, which was against the law in Tennessee just recently. And when they heard about this, they thought, wow, we could put a trial on in this town. We would attract a lot of attention, perhaps. And then maybe someone might put money into the mine, and the town would get back on its feet. And they succeeded brilliantly, in a sense. I mean, the trial was a huge event. It was called the Trial of the Century. And it was the last, there hasn't been a debate like this ever since. It was a debate, really, about the relative value of faith on the one hand and reason and science on the other. William Jennings Bryan came down, who was an ex-presidential candidate and a huge figure in American life. Clarence Darrow came down, who was an extraordinarily famous defense lawyer. The trial was broadcast live every single day, all over America, all over Europe, Australia. It was a huge event, an unimaginably big event. And this big debate took place, and the population of the town swelled up to 6,000, again, the number it had had when it had been a boom town. And then after 2 weeks, the trial was dealt with and, you know, scopes lost, and everybody disappeared again, and the town was back exactly where it started from. Well, the reenactment is there for the same reason. It attracts tourists to the town, and it makes little money. I was going to go there for the reenactment, and because I was so busy, I was writing a script for MGM at the time, and I was trying to deliver it every day, and I was working. I was getting up at 4 in the morning and not coming home until 8, and I was writing, and I got the wrong weekend for the reenactment and arrived a week late. And I just couldn't believe that this was my first book. I'd been paid for it. I'd sold it on the basis of, you know, how comic it would be to go down and see the reenactment and all of this stuff. And then I missed it. It was the most horrible moment when I realized I went across the diner and I saw this newspaper and it said, Scopes trial attracts 1,000 guests. And then the article described how all these people had seen it and the last show was on Thursday. And I was there and it was Saturday. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe this. And so that, in a way, is what made the accidental memoir come into the book, because I saw that I was in a crisis and that my crisis was not unconnected to the crisis that William Jennings Bryan had foretold. If you took God out of someone's life, this was the kind of thing that would happen. You know, you'd just fall apart. And so the book is a strange sort of mixture of comedy and tragedy, and this was definitely both.
Yeah, well, you've got a much better book as a result of missing the trial.
Thank you. It's a funny book.
Yeah. In the book, you write when you get on board that bus, you talk about your life as a screenwriter, and there's a sentence: "They pay, I deliver; they own." And it just sounds like what a monstrous thing to come face to face with. It's like you're working, and it's never your own.
It is. The Writers Guild of America actually is sort of fighting for screenwriters now to make some sort of a provision that the ultimate copyright of a script should revert back to the writer. I don't know if it'll ever go anywhere, but I think that's the way it should happen. Because, you know, you write, I mean, I must have written, I think, somewhere around 30 screenplays for the studios. 8 of them have been made, 5 of them I've directed. And the others don't exist. When you write a book, if it doesn't get published, it's in its final form on some level. You can put it on a shelf, you can tell your children to read it, and it is what it's supposed to be. A screenplay is smoke if it doesn't get made. It's meaningless. It drifts away into nothing. And it's a fairly brutal environment to work in, Hollywood. I mean, I've survived and done well and made a lot of money and all of that, but I have to say that the actual process of writing a book is a lot more pleasurable.
Is writing a book something you'd like to do again?
Yes, I've got a couple of books I'm going to write.
Good.
I'm going to keep on writing screenplays, and I'm going to go back to directing, too. But it is, it's great to write a book. And if you write, particularly I think, you know, writing your first book, I imagine, is always great. It's so solitary and peaceful, and then you have this relationship with an editor. I'm sure there are relationships with editors that are not pleasant. But at least it's an individual. When you're dealing with Hollywood, there's usually 5 or 6 people who, you know, who are involved in giving you advice about how you should write. None of them have, none of them have written before. So it's just a peculiar process.
I wondered, as you were writing the book, if you found it interesting, challenging, just old-fashioned fun, for the change that it offered you in terms of how you are able to tell a story. Because writing a screenplay, it seems to me that most films are fairly linear, and in Trials of the Monkey, you're able to go back and forth and... do you know what I'm trying to
I do,
ask
yeah, well,
you?
I mean, one of the strange things to me about the book is that it's written in two tenses. It's written in the past and it's written in the present, and the present tense. And no one has noticed this. No one and no reviewer has ever mentioned, you know, it's strange, this book, you know, some of it's in the past tense, some of it's in the present tense. And this is something I'm very proud of, because I think the book actually, although it's very literary in form, it's also been helped by my experience of screenwriting, in that in a screenplay, you're constantly cutting back and forth between different events. And in the book, and by, you know, you use the cutting back and forth as a method of maintaining suspense and keeping people interested. And I think the book actually has some of those screenwriting principles in it. And that part of the reason why, even though it does go off on tangents and rants and, you know, it deals with my mother and it deals with Dayton and it, today and me today and Hollywood and Dayton 25 years ago and history and, you know, it discusses God and faith and what it's like to not have faith and, you know, even though it has all of these things, it's held together by fairly strong dramatic principles of leaving people wanting more. And I think that's why that's where the screenwriting has helped in the book.
We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this listener who's listening to us in Indiana this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, if he were writing a review of the movie Inherit the Wind, what would he say about it?
Okay.
Well, I think actually it's not a bad movie. I think it's a little exaggerated. I think the portrayal of William Jennings Bran doesn't do justice to him, because to understand William Jennings Bran, you really have to understand what he used to be. And William Jennings Bran was actually a sort of a fantastic orator. He was a supporter of women's rights. He was a supporter of a limited work day. He helped with the child labor laws. He was a very, you know, he was a very interesting politician. And unfortunately, by the time he got to the trial, he had come down to this, really to being interested in religion, and a particular kind of fundamentalist religion. That really, I think, is a sort of a degeneration of him as a human being. I thought he was more interesting in his early years, but he wasn't a stock villain by any means. And there was a lot to admire in him. I don't think Mencken, H.L. Mencken, the reporter, was dealt with in as interesting a way as he could have been. Mencken was an extraordinary character, I think. I think that the true story of how the town put the whole trial together is actually a lot more funny and interesting than it is portrayed in the film.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question this afternoon. Other calls are invited, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Inherit the Wind was remade for television twice in 1988 and 1999. I think that's really interesting. I think it says something about the relevance of the issues raised in the story, that these issues remain relevant today.
Well, I think they do, and I think, I mean, quite recently in Kansas, there was an attempt to diminish the teaching of evolution. And, you know, I imagine it'll go on for quite a while. You know, so long as there are people around who interpret the Bible in such a literal fashion. I think there'll continue to be attempts to try and stop people getting, you know, one of the most accepted scientific truths that exists. You know, the theory of evolution is no more unproved, really, than the theory that the Earth is round and goes around the sun, you know.
How do classrooms in Dayton, Tennessee, tackle the subject of evolution?
Well, they are taught evolution, and I actually interviewed one of the science teachers at Dayton High, and he teaches evolution, but he teaches a second class, which I think is called an origins class, in which he teaches a different way of looking at it, you know, a creationist view of it. So it's, you know, I think it's a, you know, I think it's a, I think it's as, the whole thing is as relevant today as it was in 1925. And in fact, I think it's, you know, in light of what's happening in, you know, in America and the world now, where, you know, you do have someone who, in Bin Laden, you have someone who clearly is motivated by religious fervor, by faith in God. If you look at the recent videotape, everything seems to come from faith in God. So I think this is a very interesting time to be discussing these issues. And you know, as the defense, as Scope's defenders, as Clarence Darrow said in 1925, it's quite possible to interpret the Bible in all kinds of different ways. And really, the danger from any kind of faith is when it gets too narrow and too intolerant. You know.
Well, what's the old saw about the devil citing scripture?
I don't know that.
The devil can cite scripture to fit his own purposes.
Right. So. Well, I think it's certainly very malleable. When I was down there, I got very friendly with some Christian students at the Bryan College up on the hill, the Christian college there, and really liked them and saw how their life could become very interesting, you know, because they would go out and they'd be missionaries. And in fact, two of my friends are now in Egypt. Other ones had been in Afghanistan quite recently. And, you know, in talking to them about faith and reason and all of that, you know, I could really sympathize with their point of view. But there were other students who I met who, for example, were refusing to perform in a skit at the college because the skit involved a man dressing up as a woman. And they cited that in Deuteronomy there was a verse in there that forbade any man to dress up as a woman. And so they were using a verse in Deuteronomy to dictate how they would behave. But if you look at other parts of Deuteronomy, there are things in it that allow parents to have their children stoned to death, that allow men who are at war to take female prisoners captive, shave their heads, rape them. So you kind of think, well, if one verse in Deuteronomy is going to dictate how you behave, why shouldn't these other verses dictate how you behave? You know, so you begin to look at the whole thing, and it's I think that the people who interpret the Bible literally box themselves into a corner that is kind of ultimately ludicrous and dangerous, you know, and unnecessary. I think you can have faith without, you know, without this literal interpretation of the Bible. What do you believe?
Oh. Yeah, I think you can have faith without a literal interpretation. I think that you could be a religious person and believe in evolution. I don't know that they're incompatible at all.
Right. Well, that was what the trial was about.
Yeah. We've got another listener waiting to talk with us in Bloomington on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Really appreciate this interesting discussion. Appreciate the sensibility of the author. But I have two questions.
Okay.
One is, why do you argue that agnosticism is more defensible than atheism? Is it because the evidence is uncertain? And if that's the case, the evidence is always, to some extent, uncertain for almost any claim. And the second question is, would you comment on the social Darwinian side of Mencken? Because if I have to choose between Mencken, who says the strong should rule the weak, and Bryan, who says the weak should be protected by the strong, I think I'd take Bryan.
Well, the first one first. What I really think is that I don't think it's essential to reach a conclusion about everything. I think that it's perfectly acceptable to say that certain things in life are a mystery, and that certain other things in life, like, I believe, God, will always remain a mystery. I can't see any... I find it hard to believe that at any time there will be a sort of a proof of God's existence that would have to hold up in a court of law. And to me, it's okay. It's okay to say, well, we can't prove this. Therefore, it's okay not to come down on either side of the argument. To come down on the side of the argument that God does not exist is as much an act of faith as to come down on the side that God does exist. At least if you come down on the side that God does exist, you may get some benefit from it. But to simply, and perhaps you get a certain benefit from being an atheist too, and that you kind of, there's one area of life that you can sort of put over to a side and say, okay, I've decided that issue. But I think it's far more radical and far more interesting to say, it's just unprovable. And I just think that the whole issue of faith as a way, as a method by which you live your life, is overrated. And that you constantly see things in life where people say, well, I believe such and such. And you think, well, why do you believe this? And the fact is they believe it because it makes them feel better. But what makes you feel better may not in the long run be the right thing for society or the future or truth, you know. And so I just think faith is overrated and skepticism and critical thinking is very, very, very underrated. And I think you see it in all levels of life. I don't think there's anything more ridiculous about people in Dayton, Tennessee, or any fundamentalist Christian belief. I don't think it's any more ridiculous than the belief that you see in Hollywood with practically everybody in astrology, which to me is equally unfounded. There's less foundation for astrology than there is for sort of Bible-based belief. As for Mencken and his social Darwinism, I don't know, Mencken's a very hard guy to comment on seriously because so much of what he did was done for comic effect. And certainly I myself believe in protecting the weak. And as I said, I think that Brian's political views in his early life were commendable and terrific. And I don't think that there was anything evil, I hate to use that word, but I don't think there was anything malicious about Brian's desire to protect the Bible in 1925. I just think it was misguided. And, I think Brian asked a very interesting question during the trial. Almost in despair, he says, what are we taking from the children? How will the life of the children be if they can't believe in God and an afterlife? This was when he was faced with all kinds of sort of logical questions about the Bible and creation and the origins of the earth. What he was concerned about really was not truth, but happiness. And he believed that it was a happier condition to believe in God than not to believe in God. And sort of unintentionally, I think he was saying, it doesn't matter if it's true or not, if it does you good. I don't believe that. I think it does matter what is true and what is provable and what is not provable. I think it matters very much, particularly in a democracy, where the democracy flourishes through the intelligence and reasoning ability of the population to be able to say, yes, I think that makes sense. No, I don't think that makes sense. So that's just my view of the whole thing, and it's a view that comes with a great deal of sympathy for people who do believe.
Oh, that's very well spoken.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Do you think we are apt to confuse faith and happiness?
Well, I don't know. I think I certainly saw, in a way it surprised me how some of the people I met when I was asking these questions, which, as I say, are questions that one doesn't normally ask in life, you would have someone who would answer you who would say, I have absolute faith that God exists. I have absolute faith that God loves me. I have a personal relationship with God. I believe that when I die, I will go to heaven. I believe when I get to heaven, I will meet all the people who I've lost. And you kind of think to yourself, well, why aren't you happier? If I genuinely believed all those things, I would be the happiest man on earth. My mother died several years ago, and she was a very complicated woman, and we had a very difficult relationship because of her alcoholism. But I adored her, and I miss her every single day, and it's a sort of a melancholy thing in me. If I really believed that I was going to meet her in an afterlife, I would be way, way happier. So you wonder why these people who have this fabulous kind of faith and these beliefs that, you know, seem so reassuring and fantastic, why aren't they happier? Why do you get people, you know, why do you get so many crazy, unhappy people in a country that is 98% of Americans believe in God? That being so, how come we have so many serial killers and drug addicts and child abuse and theft and anger and violence? You know, why isn't religion having the advertised effect?
Writing this book, did it give you a greater understanding of how and why your mother became so engulfed in sorrow and why she was so unhappy?
In a way, and in a way not. I mean, the great, you know, she was an extremely intelligent woman, very funny, had made one strange kind of mistake in her late 20s, early 30s, where she'd had an affair with my father's partner and had secretly had my father's partner's child, who was brought up as one of us. And my father had discovered this. And this was a sort of a malignant thing in their marriage, even though he'd sort of forgiven her. And after that, she descended into sort of a middle-class, promiscuous, alcoholic descent. But somehow you can't use a single event, I don't think, to comprehend a lifelong misery that was sort of inexplicable to me as a child and remains so to this day, because I really think she loved me, and I think she loved my brothers and sister. And I remember thinking all my childhood, if she loves us, surely it must be possible to overcome this disease. And although in England in those days one didn't necessarily think of it as a disease, but it was so miserable, the drinking, that you'd think, if you loved someone, surely you'd be able to get over it. Surely you'd be able to abandon that thing so that you could make life more bearable for the people who you loved. That mystery, ultimately, I couldn't solve in the book, although I try as hard as I can. And I certainly forgive her because, you know, whatever that misery was, it was very profound and destroyed her. And, you know, very sad, very sad.
Well, I think what you've done here is, you know, short of meeting her on the other side, and I think, you know, this is, you know, I think this is so important, and maybe all of us need to accidentally, if not write it, think of a memoir, think memoir.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about writing this book has been, I mean, it is a very candid book, and I admit to all kinds of weaknesses and sins in my youth. And I had a very strange, you know, I had sort of 50 jobs before I was 30. And, you know, I left school very early, and I was a vandal, and I had a very strange youth, you know, by my own decision. And I've been completely honest about my life and honest about my childhood and honest about my marriage today and honest about how I feel about my life. And it's a very self-deprecating, self-critical, self-examining book. And one would think a very specific book, you know, The Great-Great-Grandson of Charles Darwin, fighting education all his life and then sort of going through a period of being very alcoholic and difficult and strange adventures and then coming out the other end of it. The strange thing is that by telling the truth, I think you sort of hit something that affects everybody. My daughter goes to a school in New York, which is a very sort of Upper East Side, snotty kind of a place. And I've gone to several book clubs with my book, and the women who I thought were completely, women and men who I would think were completely different from me, and their backgrounds are completely different, they come up to me and they say, you know, it's amazing, you're just like I am. And you realize that everybody, if you tell the truth, everybody can understand some part of it, because we all feel on some level lost and lonely, and we all have melancholy, and we all feel we've fallen short of, perhaps not all, but most people feel that they've fallen short in certain areas. And that's the most extraordinary thing to me about the book, is how people from all levels, including, I might say, people in Dayton whose views are diametrically opposed to mine, will have called me up and said, and people who were very angry about the book until they read it, have then called me up and said, you know, I totally understand how you feel. You know, I feel exactly the same way. Their solution is different, but their experience ultimately is the same, and it's universal.
Well, there we have to wrap it up because our time is gone. Matthew Chapman, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Matthew Chapman has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His book, Trials of the Monkey, an Accidental Memoir, is published by Picador.
I have 292.